My name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Carl Gables group. I haven't found necessary to have a drink, nor have I had one since January 25th, 1981. And I'm grateful for that, grateful to God. And thank you, James. And it's a privilege. It's always good for me to be at an AA meeting. It's a privilege whenever anybody asks you to share at an AA meeting. You can't hear you. Leon, let me get this closer. Well, there's technical stuff. Okay, there we go. Is that okay? Okay, so they told me, John C. told me that I'm doing the steps over the KISS group, and he told me that he fell asleep during my last step meeting because he's heard that deal before, so I'm supposed to come up with some new material. I've been sober for a while. I've been married for 32 years, something like that. I'm not sure. My wife asked me the other day, she said, are we going to be together in heaven? I said, sweetie, it's till death do us part. At death, I'm out of here. I signed on until death. Don't even bother looking for me, you know? I had to tell the other day I was just kidding. I really wasn't, but I told her. So I got four kids and six grandkids. They're gorgeous. Yeah, I got the pictures. Got 3,000 pictures of my grandkids to show you. So I've been doing this stuff for a long time. I think ever since after I was 3 years sober, I'm an attorney by trade, you know, so I'm a paid bullshit artist, and I've been a litigator for many years. So I've been doing this sort of stuff. We all have different talents. Talking about how the Lord, how God has changed my life, and ever since I was 3 years sober, I was doing this sort of deal. So it's a real privilege. I always get a great deal of pleasure and satisfaction out of sharing some of the stuff that's happened to me. I really just pray just to be helpful and transparent, and I don't really prepare much, which you probably all have realized by now, and I wouldn't want to, you know, if I start preparing, the ego gets in the way. I start worrying about, what does this sound like? What does that sound like? I don't want to run it through that filter. That's a wonderful filter to get rid of. You know, right around the time you start losing fear of people, you start becoming honest and transparent, and that's what I want to be. I want to be genuine, and as genuine as you could be, being an alcoholic. So I was. Now, it says our stories disclose in a general way. By the way, just in case I miss this, I'm not going to talk a lot. It's not going to be a big drunkalogue. You're just going to have to trust me that I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous because I used to drink. I used to drink against my will. You know, you ever do that deal where you wake up in the morning and say, I'm not going to have a drink today, and by 5 o'clock you're drunk? Then you wake up the next morning and say, I'm not going to buy booze today, and by 5 o'clock you're searching for dimes, nickels, and quarters so you can, you know, buy a quart bottle of Carlos Rossi Chianti and sit by the phonograph record and drink yourself until you're unconscious. And I say, I'm not going to go to the bar today. And I did it over and over. You know, when you start drinking against your will, my life turned into a bottle. And that's why I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I didn't come to find God or to change my personality. I thought I had a great I told my sponsor when I was upset one day, and I told him, he said, you ought to watch that anger thing. He said, I said, well, that's just my personality. He says, well, it's your personality that's killing you. And, you know, and it's easy to get rid of the alcohol, but what do you do when they tell you got to get rid of your personality when you're in love with your personality and your personality is killing you? And I think I'm going to talk a little bit about that deal, what that means to me. You know, that has a, you know, the first step in getting out of jail is you got to know you're in jail in the first place. And the first jail I had to find out about was the imprisonment of alcohol. But, you know, as you all know from reading the book, the alcohol is really a symptom of the disease. I didn't even know anything about alcoholism when I was drinking. All I knew about was drunk. I didn't even know what alcoholism felt like, because every time I would feel alcoholic or alcoholism would creep upon me, I would say, I need a drink, and I would get drunk. And, you know, I wouldn't feel it, because alcohol is one of those things we use in order to get rid of the alcoholism. It's just the best medicine. You know, no woman, no car. You know, I use women. I use cars. I use things. Believe me, I've spent more money I don't have buying things I don't need to impress people I don't like than you could possibly imagine. I mean, you use money. You use things. You use people. You use cars. You use cell phones. You use TV set. You use use whatever you have to use to distract you from the fact that you feel like a piece of shit. You know, and that's the bottom line. It didn't matter that I had a law degree, National Science Foundation Fellow, Division Chief of State, whatever. It doesn't matter, all the accolades, whatever the hell I earn or I think I need in order to make myself okay. The fact of the matter is, deep down inside, I always thought I was a nothing. I was always trying to prove something. Always thought I was insufficient. You know, when you think you're a nothing, you're always going to be nothing. I used to put something in my body, it turned me into an almost. When you're nothing, almost is top of the world. And that's what I used alcohol. I used alcohol in order to somehow fit in. I used to think I love people. You know, you tell yourself a lot of lies. I used to rationalize a lot, tell myself rational lies. You tell yourself a lot of stuff that it's absolutely untrue, but you buy into it. You say things like, well, I love people. If you love people, why'd you always have to get drunk in order to be around them? You know, you say things like, I don't give a crap what other people think about me. If you don't give a crap what other people think about you, if you don't care about other people's judgment, why do you spend your entire life worrying about what other people think about you? Or how you're going to look, or what you're going to do? Why is everything run through the filter, no matter what you're thinking about, well, what would this look like to other people? I mean, my whole life is about, you know, what am I going to look like? What are they going to think? What's going to happen to me? And all that sort of stuff. So filled with fear. But, of course, you don't know that because what it says men and women drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. They're restless, irritable, discontented, sober, unless they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. You know, and then they say, and of course, the real problem is not alcohol. The real problem is sobriety. Because when I'm sober, then the alcoholism comes at me full force, and that's the problem. I didn't really experience alcoholism until I was 3 or 4 months sober. And then it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and you're sitting there in bed, and you can't go to sleep, and those thoughts are coming at you like an Atari game at a million miles per hour, all bad, crappy thoughts about yourself and other people. All sorts of fears and anxieties and crap like that that you can't do anything about, you know. And it's just, that's the story of the alcoholic's life. And you know it's not alcohol because you haven't had a drink in 3 or 4 months, and it's not alcohol. It's something called alcoholism. And you can stop the drinking, but how do you stop the thinking? And that's and you find that you're as addicted or even more addicted to the thinking than you were to the drinking. And unfortunately, it's like Carl Menninger said in his book Man Against Himself, published in the 30s, in the chapter on alcoholism, he says alcoholics are men and women who are out to destroy themselves. I don't think I realized the extent, first of all, I certainly didn't realize the seriousness of the disease until I had many years recovery, but I don't think I recognized the extent to which I held inside of me hatred, anger, and fear. You know, nobody could have the thoughts that I had about other people and about myself unless you had a tremendous amount of hatred, anger, and fear, all somehow mixed together, interrelated. And most of the hatred really towards myself. You know, and I'll talk a little bit about it in a second or two, but it's a wonderful thing to be sober, and to be sober for quite frankly a while, because for the first, I got a 10 or 15 years, you know, 20 years maybe. I'm used to getting better like that. You know, I'm an alcoholic. I get better like immediately. You know, I'm not feeling good. I get better like that. Just give me a drink, whack, and I'm okay. And that's what that's what alcoholics are used to. What alcoholics are used to, one of the old, is that somehow, some way, I can get better like that. Even when we stop drinking, we think we can get better like that. We go up to the guy and the guru, whoever it is, you know, we ask him questions like he'll tell us something, we'll get better like that. And, you know, anybody who's been around here for a while knows it doesn't work like that. You know, that is 15 years, you know, and that's, it takes time. You know, things take time. You know. It's a nervous laugh I hear. So in any event, what if this son of a bitch is right? I am right, but it's okay. So, but what happens is the good thing about, what happens is with the time I have now and, you know, my sponsor is 57 years, so, you know, it's just with the time I have now, I've had occasion as time goes on, you just see more things. You start connecting dots. You connect the dots. You see things. The first 10 or 15 years I spent in hand-to-hand combat with reality, you know, because now you're not drinking, but you're still thinking, you're still working, you're still dealing with life, you're raising kids, you're raising grandkids, you're dealing with bosses, you're dealing with judges, you're dealing with life, you're dealing with people in AA, you're dealing with all the horseshit and wonderfulness that is life. And if you're an alcoholic, you understand what that's all about. That's like crisis management. Because if you're an alcoholic, everything is like horribleness and a crisis, and it's all going to lead to your death. There's no probation; it's always death. And it's a wild deal. And you know, so for the first 15, but you know, the truth of the matter is, and I thought that would never go away, and I thought it would never stop, and it has stopped. And it took a while, but it has stopped, and you get to sort of see things and look back on things, and see how things sort of fit together. I was, I had four of my grandkids and a niece over. I have four granddaughters and two grandsons, and I think I had four of my granddaughters over, and one of my grandnieces over, and there must have been a grandson over because there was a little boy there too or something. I don't know. They show up at the table. I feed them. What do I know? They're, I forget their names. I mix them all up, you know. But they're between the ages of like 5 and 9 or 10. They're really cute. And two dogs. I got James and Rachel's dog now because we're trying to get puppies with our frigid Shih Tzu, you know. Well, either our Shih Tzu is frigid or his or Bruno Ravioli has a problem with women. I don't know. We haven't figured that one out. My wife knows all about that deal. Has some dogs going to the heat or something. But in any event, doesn't sound too exciting, does it? When you get 33 years and you're 65 years old, the life of a 33 year sober, 65 year old alcoholic doesn't really sound too exciting, does it? Bunch of grandkids and dogs and stuff like that. And my daughter the other day, you know, they call me. My daughters call me. They say, "Dad, you're such a lame. You're so boring. You're such a lame." I said, "Oh man, thank God I almost died out there on the streets with the excitement." I took some guy about 10 years ago to an AA meeting, and he, you know, some new guy, and he liked it and he loved it, and we went to a Denny's afterwards, and we're sitting at the Denny's and having coffee at 10:30 on a Saturday night, and I was talking to him about AA or whatever the heck I was talking about. I think I had about 10 years at the time, and he was brand new, and he looked at me. He was about 20 years old, and he said to me, he says, "Well, you know, that was really great, that name." He says, "But what do you guys do for fun? It's 10:30 and at Denny's, we're the only ones there on a Saturday night." He says, "What do you guys do for fun?" And I didn't have the heart to tell him that I was having a good time. I said, "What am I going to say?" I said, "In AA, this is it. This is Valhalla. This is like the Playboy Mansion in AA." And I was talking to an old guy at 10:30 in a Denny's drinking crummy coffee, you know. So in any event, I was so I have these kids over, and I walked out of my room, you know, at around 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday morning. They had slept overnight. And I guess their parents wanted to get rid of them for a while. They dropped them off at grandpa and grandma. So and the entire living room, it's hard to describe this. I wish I had a picture of it. The entire living room, they had rearranged all the furniture. You know, a couple of sofas and chairs in the living room and sort of put them together. And they had taken blankets, found blankets, heavy blankets, and they had draped it over the furniture. So it was, I don't know how to explain it, it was like a giant tent. In the middle of the living room, they had built like a fort, you know, and I heard giggling coming from inside the fort. And they were inside. The only problem is they had blocked off. You couldn't get around. You couldn't get from one side of the house to the other side of the house because the fort blocked off everything. And they were giving. I heard things like, "See him? He's here." I started to, you know, and I saw that, you know, and you know, I'm sure if I was drinking or if I was a drunk, I wouldn't have noticed that. But I started remembering, you know, I started remembering that when I was their age, I used to do that. I don't know how many other people used to do that. When I was a kid, we used to have like forts made out of the same shabby sort of stupid stuff as they did, you know. Like if we were all together on a Friday night watching Empty Graves or something, we'd build a fort like with blankets, you know what I mean? And And I lived on Long Island Sound, and if we had, we would go down there and we'd scoop out like a cave in one of the dunes or something. We'd have like this little fort with, we were only two people could fit in it, you know what I mean? And we'd have these little forts that we built, and we went in there, you know, we would just do that for a period of time when we were young. And I started thinking about why kids do that. I did that, and they did that, and they're inside all together, huddled together. Shh, you know, he's there. And I started remembering that when I was in the fort, I remember now, I said, when I was in the fort, even though it was a flimsy, stupid little fort, and I was with like one other person, I felt safe. I felt safe in the fort. You know what I mean? Inside the blanket. You know what I mean? I felt, you know, inside the blanket. On the front, when you got the blanket and the flashlight, you know what I mean? And you're inside the fort, you're safe from nuclear attack. An atom bomb can't even hurt you. You know, nobody can hurt you inside the fort. And, I felt better inside the fort than outside the fort. There was something about being inside the fort, separated, even by a blanket, from the rest of the world, than being outside the fort. Now, there came a time when I stopped building forts. What, I don't know what it was, 11, 12, 13. And I started thinking about that. I said, you know, there really did come a time, maybe that's just something that little kids do, that I stopped building forts, But I believe, and I absolutely believe this, that the reason I stopped building the forts, what really happened is not because all of a sudden I felt safe outside the fort as I did inside the fort. I think I stopped building forts because I got used to feeling unsafe. I think you get used to feeling unsafe. I think if you're an alcoholic, you get used to living in fear. I think you get used to living in worry. I think you get used to living in anxiety. I think you get used to worrying about what's going to happen to you, what people are thinking about you. You know, you get used to feeling unsafe in the world, not good in the world. And you sort of develop other little things or other stuff or distractions or whatever it is in order to take your mind off the fact that you're scared. And I think that's what the big book says when it talks about how we're restless, we're irritable, we're full of this disease. But it says, this is what it says. It says this great line. It says, our alcoholic life seems the only normal one. And I think for people like me, what happens is that you really do walk around with a corrosive thread of fear inside of you. Incredible fear. Fear of people, fear of their judgments, fear of what they'll think about you. I think you walk around with a tremendous amount of hatred and anger towards yourself and towards other people. You know, I couldn't have the bad thoughts about myself and other people and the kind of the way I took things personally, the way it was easy in order almost automatic for me to draw out a resentment or a blame or feel sorry for myself. I couldn't have had that unless I was filled with anger and resentment and fear. And I think what happens is you get so used to, even as a young age, even at 6 years old on, you get so used to living with all that fear and resentment and anger and whatever it is that it just feels normal and natural to you. You've never lived. That's why in the book it says we're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. It doesn't say we're going to be happy again. Or we're going to be free like we always. It says we're going to know a new freedom, and we're going to know a new happiness. We're going to know peace. That's what it says. When we sincerely took this position, all sorts of remarkable things happen. We lose God. He says our Heavenly Father, being all powerful, give us everything we need if we stay close to Him and perform His works well. He says we'll lose a concern of our little plans and designs and have more concerns for other people and how we can help them. Fear of today, yesterday, and the hereafter will leave us, will be reborn if we utterly give our life over to Him. That's what it says in the big book. That's what this thing is all about to me. That's what real sobriety, emotional sobriety is. Bill Wilson called it the next frontier. He said the real problem is that it says that we have unhealthy dependencies. In the big book it says the real deal, back between 1935 and 39, before the big book was written, you know, the book that says, rarely have we seen a person fail a slowly followed up path. So the real deal is that we've experienced much of heaven, we've been rocketed in the fourth dimension of existence. That God has become the centerpiece of our life. That without question, we have no doubt that he lives in our hearts and minds in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has done for us what we can't do for ourselves. You know, and that's what it says throughout the book. It says we never apologize for God. He says our life is on a new basis now. The basis of trust and relying upon God. It says, and then we have serenity and we'll know peace. You know, and I've seen a lot of people, I've sponsored hundreds of men, I've seen a lot of people go through AA, and they all get sober, physically sober, they all join the not drinking club. You know, AA's been watered down quite a lot. I don't know how to, I don't want to hurt your feelings, I love AA, or I don't want to make you feel bad, but AA's been watered down quite a lot since 1935. And, you know, between 1935 and 1939, they used to have you get down on your knees, give your life to the Lord. You know, before you can get into a meeting, you can check it out. I'm not telling you anything that's not in the material, conference-approved material. You know, talk about in the good old days. And when we wrote, and in the book that you read, it says, rarely have I seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And their path at that time, with the three books they found were absolutely essential, was 1 Corinthians 13, Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 6, and 7, and the book of James. And, of course, in AA, not only aren't they essential anymore, but people will stone you if you mention anything about that stuff. You know, unless you have 33 years, then they don't stone you so much. You know, they get interested sometimes because they may want what you have. They may want more than just mere sobriety. They may want the peace. They may want to be rocketed in the fourth dimension of existence. They may want that to experience much of heaven. But there are some people that don't want what we have. They just want to stay sober. And you can join the not drinking club. They really start forwarding this down from the beginning. The requirement to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous was not much. All you needed was an honest desire to stay sober. And then they took the word honest away. You know, they took because that would be you know the way that's sort of like they took the word honest away because they wanted to allow you to come in. You know, it didn't even matter. Just come on. And now, you know, now we don't have you get down on your knees anymore. Now they hand up. At least they, because adopting humility, what they found out with alcoholics is the essential ingredient of recovery was humility. Because if you're anything like me, for many reasons, you're an arrogant, know-it-all son of a bitch. And you're stubborn, and your chief characteristic is defiance. That's just the nature of the disease. It just goes with the disease. It's like chicken pox. You got, you know, chicken pox, you know, mumps. If you're an alcoholic, you're just an arrogant, self-centered, selfish, know-it-all, you know, stubborn son of a bitch. That's just the disease of alcoholism, you know. And that's not me. Just read the big book. It says selfishness, self-centeredness, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking. We step in the toes of others. They retaliate. Where self will run riot, though we usually don't think so. Above everything, we must get rid of selfishness. We must or it kills us. God makes that possible. This is all basic AA stuff. And you don't have a shot of having a relationship with God or doing this thing or getting what they got unless you somehow, some way, can adopt some sort of humility. And if you're anybody like me, humility is a foreign word to me. I don't know anything about humility. I know about arrogance. I can write a book on arrogance. But I'll tell you what I do know about. I do know about humiliation. And what they found with alcoholics, and Dr. Thibault found this, is that what we need is routine and constant humiliation and death. And that's why that's the first thing that happens in here. You get humiliated to the point where you actually at least come in here. Now, in the old days, they knew how to humiliate you. They would tell you, you want to get in, get down on your knees. And it's humiliating. It's humbling to get down on your knees in front of, you know, 10 or 15 or 20 people. You know, give your life to God, you know, and give. That's humiliating. And but you know something? People would do it. I guess they were desperate. And they would do it. And then they'd be allowed in the meetings and, you know, those must have been interesting meetings, huh? When you have to do that, that's a real deal breaker. That's a real filter, don't you think? You know, you don't even have to worry about the six steps separating the men from the boys. You separate them out right there. You separate out the bullshit from the non-bullshit. You separate out the ones that have an honest desire to stop drinking from the guys that say, well, what the hell, it's Saturday night and the judge wants me to be here, so maybe it'll make the wife happy. You separate that stuff out right away, so you get a more serious, intense crowd, but nowadays we become nicer, you know what I mean? And in the idea and the guise of sort of like helping the alcoholic, we've sort of like loosened up the program. So we took away the way honest. Now you don't have to be honest. You just have to have a desire to stay sober. And we don't have to get down on your knees anymore. So we adopted this little custom in AA where we hold up a white chip. Yeah, that's the way I did it. And that shows a little humility because you got to go from the back of the room to the front of the room, and you got to actually pick up a chip and sort of in front of people. It's sort of like a little bit humiliating. And you know, that's what it says in the 12 and 12. It's the way we get a new perspective by 100 forms of humiliation, the final crushing of our self-sufficiency. Because unless we're humiliated, unless we're crushed, we'll just keep on doing what we're doing. And tell our sponsor, we'll go screw yourself, or I'm going to get another sponsor, you know, or just chuckle at life, you know, and think we're getting away with something. So humiliation and crushing and all that stuff is absolutely necessary. You know, it's part and parcel of the program, the sixth and seventh steps. So, but even in AA, if you look at the fellowship, you know, the Well People's Anonymous here, if you look at the fellowship, even in Alcoholics Anonymous, the fellowship many times, and I love the fellowship, but many times it works actually against the actual program. I mean, you know what the program says? It says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Am I making this stuff up? Isn't that what it says? Have you guys ever heard this thing? Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Operative word there is thoroughly. Listen, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Isn't that the program? Isn't that in the big book? Whatever their path was, you do what we did, you'll get what we got, right? And what does Well People's Anonymous say? Take what you like and leave the rest. The program says, do this exactly the way it's laid out. It even writes a book, Chapter to the Agnostics. You know, it says this kind of thinking has to be abandoned. The program says you have to have a relationship with God. This kind of thinking has to be abandoned. Rarely have seen a person fail, it's thoroughly followed our path. And, you know, burn the idea into every person's mind that he can do anything as long as he trusts God and clean house. That's what the program says. The fellowship says, the fellowship is made up, and we always cater to the lowest common denominator, the one who wants to do it the least. The fellowship says, take what you like and leave the rest. You don't like God, throw it away. You don't like the fourth step, forget about it. You don't like this, for the hell with it, right? That's what the program says. You know, we'll even have atheist meetings here, sort of like encourage atheism, you know what I mean? The program says, that's crazy. The fellowship says, go ahead and do it. Well, because most alcoholics are codependent. They worry so much about what other people think about them. You understand what other people... The last thing we want is somebody storming out of here saying, I hate that group. You know, because we can't handle the fact that somebody might not like us. So we'd rather see them die instead of giving them the truth. We don't care if they die as long as they like us as they're dying. So I said, well, that's the nature of alcoholism. The nature of alcoholism is sit around and suck your thumb and worry about yourself and what other people think about it. You know, it's so self-centered. It's like that line from Beaches, you know, enough about me, you know, what about you, what do you think about me? You know, that kind of thing. And you know, I asked my sponsor, one of my sponsors once, Joe Snyder, I said, you ever get resentment? He says, get them, I give them. I said, man, I was amazed. I had about 10 years, I was amazed. How do you do that? I still could not stand the fact that somebody might walk out on a meeting or might not like me or something. I couldn't, if I knew you didn't like, I mean, at 3 o'clock in the morning, I'd call you up and say, do you have a problem with me? Did I do it? I mean, I couldn't handle it. The fact that, you know, like one person may not like what's going on and that kind of stuff. That's part and parcel of the nature of this disease. You know, unless and until an alcoholic accepts his alcoholism and all its consequences, his sobriety will be precarious. Of true happiness, he'll find none at all. And one of the consequences of being an alcoholic is this incredibly self-centered concern about how you look to other people instead of how you look to God. And so you're less of a concern about personal integrity, more of a concern as to whether people like you. That's why most alcoholics are whores. We'll sell our integrity down the drain for anything. We'll sell our integrity down the drain for money. We'll sell our integrity down the drain for... I'm not talking about you guys. I don't want you to get nervous. I can always tell when I'm with more of an upper strata of alcoholics. I'm talking about the guys in my home group. You know what I mean? Paul Gable's group, you know? But that's why we do that. That's why we do the things we do. Hurt the people we hurt and sink to the lowest common denominator. We'll do anything. You know, if you're an alcoholic, you're a please love me a holic. I'll do anything to prostitute myself a holic, you know? I'll be anything you want me to be. I'll be a racist. You know, I'll be a sexist. I'll be anything you want to do. I'll laugh at your stupid jokes. I'll do anything. Just tell me that you love me, alcoholic. That's part and parcel of the disease. That's why we drink. That's the causes and conditions. That's why after you put the plug in the jug, you're still a banana. You're still crazy. So that's why you, in the shower, when you're lathering up and you hear that voice, you're a piece of shit, you ought to be dead, you don't deserve to live. That's where the voices come from. That's why you tell yourself you don't deserve to live. That's why you hate yourself. You know, I was told, one of the great things, I remember, you know, in the Bible, one of the great lines in the Bible is, the carpenter said, he said, you'll know my deal because, you'll know them because they love the brothers. Because people that are into this thing love other people. That's when things started turning around for me. You know, you hear people say, I couldn't love people until I loved myself. I didn't love myself for a long, long time. You know, I didn't have any feelings of self-worth to myself. I had to love other people first. I had to learn to love other people by sponsoring people, by dealing with people, by talking to alcoholics, by working with alcoholics who, believe it or not, at times can be very unlovable. Very unlovable. You know? And the more I learned to love other people and care about other people, then one day I woke up and I felt good about myself. And, of course, working these steps and doing all that sort of stuff. So that's what happened. I start, you know, you find out that you've got, after you stop drinking, I sponsored a guy. I tell this story because it's so true. You know, I mean, somewhere along the line, I think every alcoholic who's working this thing, whether you have 3 months, 6 months, or 9 months, whenever it happens, you come to the conclusion that you're crazy. You really do. You start, there's that initial wonderfulness of getting rid of the alcohol and not having the drink and not having the compulsion and being free of that, and you feel good for a while. Until the craziness starts happening, until your mind starts ganging up on you, and you realize that you really. I had a guy. I tell this great story. A guy named Tommy. It's a true story. And he was when I was in the state's attorney's office. I was division chief. He was a co-division chief with me, and we were good friends and we were drinking buddies. And I happened to come in to AA 3 years before he did. And he called me up one day. And this was a guy who was an Ivy League guy. He was a government prosecutor, very sharp guy. You know what I mean? And when he called me up, he was an attorney, he was sleeping on a friend's probation officer's floor. He had one pair of pants left, one shirt left, and his hair was down to his shoulders. And he hadn't shaved in like a week. And he had a shotgun in his mouth. And he called me up because he was supposed to be in court and he couldn't make it. And I called up the judge and worked that thing out for him because he had been drinking and drugging for who knows how long. And I went down and I picked him up and I took him to his first AA meeting. And Tommy's one of these guys. He was a couple years older than me. He was one of these guys that he took to this thing like a duck takes the water. He was like one of these guys. I think I was like that. He went into this thing and it was like as soon as he hit the room, he was home. He was like, bam. It was like instant coffee. Bam. Just that water. It was over. Tommy, that was it. Tommy came in here on day one, day two, he had cut his hair, he looked like the old Tommy, you know what I mean? He was feeling great, he was excited to be here, he was down so low, he was desperate. You know, Tommy would have gotten on his knees, he would have done whatever you had to do, you know? And the bottom line, he picked up the white chip, he came in here, he was doing great, and then a month went by, and 2 months went by. And he called me up. I think he was driving around or something like that in Tampa or something. And you know, the craziness came upon him. You know what I mean? The thinking shit, thinking stuff, you know. He started thinking about things, you know. Probably had a fear crop up or something. You know, had the thoughts that then, you know, the committee. You know, what is that? The committee, you know, the 10,000 thoughts, bad thoughts about yourself and other people coming at, you know, what am I going to do about this? What's going to happen about that? You know, all that sort of stuff. He called me up because he was worried. He thought he might have to leave AA, and AA was the only thing that ever worked for him. And he said to me, he said, Russell, he says, I got a problem. I said, what is it, Tommy? He says, I'm worried. I said, what's the problem, Tommy? He says, I think I might have to leave AA. I said, really? He says, yeah. He says, I don't think I'm an alcoholic. I said, you don't? He says, no. He says, I think I'm just crazy. And I said, Tommy, listen. He said, what? I said, you could be both. He said, really? I said, absolutely. He says, oh, thank God. I thought I had a baby. So, you know, I mean, for some of you, you've already realized you've been sober for a little while, right? And it's probably dawned upon you that you're crazy. You got crazy thoughts about yourself and other people. You can't stop thinking. You can't stop thinking about the money. You can't stop thinking about the woman. You can't stop thinking about the man. You can't stop thinking about the sex. You can't stop thinking about yourself. You can't stop thinking about your life. You can't stop thinking about your boss. You can't stop thinking about the job. You can't stop thinking about the not having the job. You can't stop thinking about the car, the house, the accident. Whatever the hell it is, you just can't stop thinking about it. You told yourself one day, you said, well, I got to stop thinking about this. This is killing me. And you stopped for 30 seconds and you picked it up again. You went into a meeting and you were thinking all these bad thoughts about yourself and other people and what's going to happen, everything. And you were 15 minutes in the meeting before you realized somebody was talking. Then all of a sudden you looked up and you saw there's the dancing monkey. Here he is, Russell. You started listening. You know, he distracted you from your thoughts. Maybe said a few things to make you feel good. A couple of truths sort of excited you a little bit. You stopped thinking about your crazy shit, right? You went to this meeting and all of a sudden the meeting was over and you felt good, right, for about 5 or 10 minutes. Then you got in your car and you drove away and you started getting crazy again. Until the next meeting, right? And so you turn on the TV and you watch the billboards as you're driving around and you live in a world where it's just a bunch of mirrors telling you how insufficient and stupid you are. Everybody on TV looks better than you. Every billboard you see says, buy this or you're an idiot. Buy this or you're stupid. You need this, you need that. You turn on the TV and the guys are all told that unless they can keep a four-hour hard-on when they're 70 years old, they're pieces of shit. The women are told unless they get breast enlargements, they're stupid, you know. It's all about buy, 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 get, have. You know, you judge who you are and what you are by what you have, what you own, how much money you have, what's in your bank account, how you look, what your weight is. You know, everything except the shit that's important. Except the stuff they talk about in here. So you go to your discussion meetings, all you do is talk about not having the crap that you need to have or losing the stuff that you think you're going to lose. The stuff you were chasing before you came in here that was driving you nuts, that didn't help you in the first place. So now you're chasing the same shit, doing the same stuff, thinking the same things. Except now instead of drinking scotch, you sit around day room and you drink coffee. And you can't understand why you feel like so shitty. When you're not even doing the program of recovery because you're not focused on God, you're still focused on the same horse shit you were focused on when you came in here. But you don't want to get better. What you want to do is you don't really want to change. You want to keep your personality. You know? I said to my sponsor, you know, you got to get these crazy sponsors that treat you like crap. You know, I said to my sponsor, I pointed to my diplomas. I have this wall with all these diplomas and certificates and stuff. And I said, and I had the unfortunate luck. I should have been sponsored by Jesus or Albert Einstein, but they were dead or something. But unfortunately, I got this guy who didn't even graduate third grade, who was a used car salesman from Chicago. And I had Bobby in my office one day, and he was looking at my, and I was showing him my wall where I have about all these diplomas and certificates, and I'm educated far beyond my capacity to understand anything. And I said, Bobby, those are my degrees. And he looked at me, he says, you know, Russ, rectal thermometers have degrees, and you know what they do with those. That's what you got. You gotta get one of those sponsors, you know what I mean? It seems like every time I was given a particle of truth, they gave me a little truth. They'd have to slug me in the solar plexus first and, you know, bring me down. They knew that's what I needed. I needed to somehow be brought down a peg. It was like every sponsor I had a way of rebuking me and sort of bringing me down a peg. You know what I mean? So I wasn't such a hot shot. And then he'd feed me the truth. And, you know, those are the sponsors I have. So I was like an abused sponsee. See, you know, when they say about abused children, they become abusers. So I guess that's the way I am, too. I don't know. But in any event, the great thing is, and I'm grateful, is after being in here, and, you know, I don't do this thing perfectly. I didn't do it perfectly, but I stuck around. I go to a lot of meetings. I probably go to more meetings now, Bible study, church, the whole bit. I do the whole deal. You know, just like saying the book where they encourage church members. I know you don't realize this, but in the program, I know if you're in the fellowship says religion bad, right? Isn't that what the fellowship says? Religion bad, church bad, you know what I mean? Clergy bad. You know what I mean? I'm spiritual, I'm not religious. Well, I know that's what the program says because the program caters to the lowest common denominator. But what the fellowship says, the fellowship of the Spirit. You know, there's another fellowship in here. There's a fellowship of the not drinking club. You know, the desire to stop drinking. And then there's the fellowship of the Spirit they talk about at the end. That fellowship gets populated around the sixth step. The sixth step, that's the step where it says it separates the men from the boys. Anyone who does this enough and repeatedly enough and is intense enough where he wants to do this in such a way so that he will constantly grow in the image and likeness of his creator, is entitled to be called a man. You know, that's the fellowship of the Spirit. And unfortunately, there are people that are just in the non-drinking fellowship, and there are people that are in the fellowship of the Spirit, a small amount, percentage of people, and we all meet in the same room. And the people that are not in the fellowship of the Spirit, they don't want to hear any of that crap. You know, they just, you know, they say, you do your program, I'll do my program, I haven't had a drink all day, thank you very much, go to hell. You know what I mean? They resent that stuff. But the ones that are in the fellowship of the Spirit who want to be in that fellowship, that want more, you understand what I'm saying? They live for that stuff. That's the stuff they want. They want the rocket ship ride in the fourth dimension. It's like Bill Dodson in Alcoholics Anonymous number 3. You know, because this is the way I was, and this is what he said in Alcoholics Anonymous number 3. It would be hard to estimate how much AA has done for me. I really wanted the program, and I wanted to go along with it. I noticed that others seemed to have such a release, a happiness, or something that I thought a person ought to have. I was trying to find the answer. I knew there was even more. I knew there was something I hadn't got. And I remember one day, a week or two after I'd come out of the hospital, Bill was at my house talking to my wife and me. We were eating lunch, and I was listening and trying to find out why they had this release that they seemed to have. Bill looked across at my wife and said to her, "Henrietta, the Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease, that I just want to keep talking about it and telling other people." I think I have the answer. Bill was very, very grateful that he had been released from this terrible thing, and he had given God the credit for having done it. And he's so grateful about it, he wants to tell other people about it. That sentence, "The Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease that I just want to keep telling people about it," has been a sort of golden text for the AA program and for me. And so when you come in here, you all really have a choice, you know. And one of the great things that happened to me is I ran into people that, you know where it says in here, he says, "I knew there was something more, something I hadn't gotten." I ran into people who were just physically sober, and I ran into people who had that other deal going on. You know what I mean? Had that rocket ship ride in the fourth dimension. They were transparent. They were authentic. They were genuine. And these were the guys. They never seemed to complain. They always seemed to be in a good mood. You know, you sort of thought that they had no problems, and you found that some of them were dying of cancer, and they were in a good mood. And they were always, their biggest concern was they were always, what they were about is trying to help other people. It wasn't about, they weren't the thumb-sucking crybabies. They weren't about, you know, poor me. They weren't about, you know, you wouldn't believe what happened to me today. They weren't about, you know, I can't believe what's happening. I can't believe my boss. They weren't about the complaining or the whining or the crisis. They were about seeing where they could say anything that was constructive so they could help other people. And those were the guys I wanted, and I didn't know how to get there because I was a thumb-sucking crybaby. I was a you-don't-understander. I was an if-onlier, you know, if-onlier, you-don't-understander, you know, from the word go. You know, all I wanted to talk about is, you know, my life and me and my problems. And if only this happened, if only that happened, everything would be okay. You know, I was a blamer. And I didn't know any other way of doing it because your alcoholic life, it's ingrained. You know, the crappy thoughts are mixed with the good thoughts. If there were any good thoughts, then they override the good thoughts. If you're an alcoholic, your entire life is emotion and feelings driven. You do worship a God. Your God is, my God was my feelings. My God was my feelings. There was nothing in this world more important than my feelings. All I thought about is how I felt. Let me tell you how an alcoholic thinks versus a non-alcoholic. Not that I know what an alcoholic is. This is an alcoholic. You see, my wife says, with the baby, she says, "We're out of milk." Now, I don't know what a non-alcoholic thinks. You know, I know how an alcoholic thinks. A non-alcoholic might think, well, I got to get milk. And probably goes down to the store and he gets milk. Now, you say to me, "We're out of milk," and this is what I think. Why do I always have to get the flicking milk? Now, I may end up getting the milk, or I may not end up getting the milk, because why? Let the bitch get the milk, you know what I mean? You know, I go out and I work all day. I struggle all day. This is a bunch of bullshit. I start weighing the fairness versus the unfairness. And I maybe start a fight with my wife. I say, "You know something? I've been working all day. Why don't you get the frickin' milk?" You know what I mean? Maybe I end up in divorce over the milk. And it's not over the milk. It's, you know what it is? It's the principle of the thing, for damn sake. It's the principle. Why am I always getting the milk? You know what I mean? Why did I get a divorce in my life? Because she didn't understand me. You know what I mean? Well, they, you know, if you go to the bars, if you sit down at the bars and you tell your buddies at the bars, you know what they say? They say you're absolutely right. They understand. They understand because they understand that nobody understands. Why should you get the freaking milk? Why are you always getting the milk? You know what I mean? Sure, you're laughing, Mike. You don't know what it's like. Yeah, you know what's funny? You got to understand something. When you have that sort of thought and it comes naturally, and you naturally always think about getting the freaking milk, and why do you always have to get the freaking milk, and why is it always your job to get the milk, and divorces happen, and terrible things happen, and yelling, screaming happens, and big arguments that lead nowhere happen over the freaking milk because you're thinking about yourself and why you're always doing it, and the fundamental unfairness, and you're always weighing what's fair and what's not fair, and always seems to be unfair when you have to do anything to go out of your way because yourself, and all you care about yourself. When that's your life, and that affects every single thought in your life on every level, whether it be work or anything like that, you don't even realize you're crazy. Because that's just a, you, when she says we're out of milk, and you say, why am I always getting the freaking milk? You don't think I'm crazy. You just think, why do I always have to get the freaking milk? That's the way alcoholics think. That's what they drink over. Their thoughts, their feelings. And somehow, even though we're brilliant, you know what our brilliance does? It allows us to justify walking out on the wife and yelling and screaming and do all that stuff with some sort of weird sort of logic, which seems absolutely perfectly sound. And then we go tell our other alky friends about it, and of course they nod their heads and say, you're right and she's a bitch. You don't get rid of her, you know what I mean? Or, you know, whatever it is, whenever the girls do that, it's the same thing, you know what I mean? And that's alcoholism. And we come in here and we think getting rid of the drink is going to do it. Only thing getting rid of the drink, getting rid of the drink is a good thing, and they get to deal with the real bullshit, which most people don't want to deal with because somehow, we feel more comfortable thinking that way than thinking the other way. Then without the emotion, he says, okay, honey, I'll go get the milk. You know, listen, how many years did I, you know why I'm married 32 years? Because I, let me tell you something. I know how to say, you're right. My sponsor said, hey, listen, you can be right or you can be happy. What do you want? I said, I want both. He says, you can't have both. Because if you got to be right, then you always got to have the last word. You always got to get, you can be right, you can be happy. After several years, I decided I'd just soon be happy. So, you know, my wife tells me, he says, you know, she starts arguing. I say, hey, listen, you're right. I plead guilty. To anything. Even if I'm not guilty, I'll plead no contest. I said, let's go straight to the sentencing. What's the fine? A blouse? We'll go to the movies? It's always something I can afford anyway, you know. I mean, I just can't handle the trial. You know, I can't handle the trial. She wants to have a trial. She says, no trial is necessary. I'm guilty. You're the worst husband in the world. Correct. You know what I mean? You never take out the garbage. You're absolutely right. You know, I never do, you know. And but you know, when you're an alcoholic, you're in a fight. Because of the injustice of the whole thing, right? That's why you can't stay married for 30 years. You get divorced every 2 weeks or something. Because they don't understand you, you know? Stuff like that. It's a serious disease, you know what I mean? So God bless you. It's 9 o'clock. Let's get out of here.